Anyway, okay, so let's start the interview.
Okay, we're to start then.
Yeah, so just this is Julianne Lyon interviewing Judy Molloy for the Hidden Histories Project. It's the 11th of August 2015, and it's 8:30 GMT, and it's 3:30 where you are. Great. Okay, so the first question is, your earliest memory of encountering computing technology.
Okay, I'm going to start with something that was pre-encountering computer technology because I think it's important to my story. And that is my first job after I graduated with a degree in English and Art was at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., where I worked as a searcher editor for the Union Catalog. Now, the Union Catalog is the Library of Congress's huge catalog that includes every book, millions and millions of records. And at that time, it was 1964, it wasn't computerized. It was a year later that they hired Henrietta Avram to come and begin computerizing the library. But I think that this was important to me because I certainly saw before they had done it the need for it. It was in this huge room in the Naval Annex, not in the Library of Congress's building itself, a huge, huge warehouse full of card catalogs. And to work on the cards, we rolled around on chairs. And it's important to me because card catalogs have pervaded my life and my work to a certain extent. And the experience of seeing so many cards and also knowing the need to automate them was of interest.
Yeah. Well, you know what always strikes me about it just struck me there again when you said about that you had to roll around on chairs. It's this like this physicality almost that often comes across from the earth in the earlier, whether it's punch cards or those earlier technologies. Even this isn't punch cards, but there's this sort of physical intervention that's one of the things that I guess we've, well, partially lost.
We've lost, and I think, I mean, this is a totally off the subject response, but it isn't of interest to me what we lost in being able to use card catalogs when we went to automated systems. But shall I continue or?
Of course.
Okay, so shortly after that, with an interval of taking camping around Europe and doing some writing, shortly after that, I went to work for, I think it was John I. Thompson Company, who would contract had a contract with the Goddard Space Center. The Goddard Space Center was at that time, it was around 1967 or six, computerizing their library. It was one of the earlier efforts to computerize libraries on a large scale. So my job there was to catalog documents and books that were in their collection, and then sometimes I key punched them in myself, and sometimes someone, a key punch operator, did that. And then what happened was I never saw the computer. So the computer was at the Goddard Space Center. We were creating the records for the computer. We took them when we were finished doing them and put them in the slot. Now, I used to think that the slot was some long tunnel to the Goddard Space Center, but when I was looking at the map and saw that the Goddard Space Center was actually not that close to where I was working, I thought it must have gone to a truck or something. But all I remember very clearly punching the cards or taking the punched cards from someone who punched them and putting them in this slot. And then there they went off to the computer. And the other thing I remember clearly is the problems with the key punch machines. Does this come up in some of your other work with key punch people operating key punch machines, how finicky they were?
Yes and no, because everybody tends to have a different focus. But when I was watching the Pathfinders interviews earlier, you told this wonderful anecdote. I don't know if you'd care to repeat it. I think it was from actually a later stage, about when you put the cards into the
Oh,
tray and And
They
it's
all swim to the air.
yeah.
Yeah. That's actually later. But the key punch machines tended to break a lot. And it turned out that the best way to fix them was to sort of hit them. It was actually a known technique for just gently slap them.
Okay.
It was something that I got very good at. Some people would call me and say, "Could you come and do whatever it is you do? Make this thing work." I remember struggling with that technology. I always enjoyed cataloging. It's kind of a relaxing kind of job. So after that, I then my boyfriend got drafted, and he was sent to Germany. I went to Germany. We got married in Germany after much paperwork. I worked in the special library system there, and then when we came back to this country, we went to Colorado, and we decided when we got to Boulder we'd like to stay there. We were camping in the mountains, so I have remember very clearly putting on a suit because you had to dress in those days. Particularly as a woman, you could not go into a company wearing pants. Putting on a suit in a tent, and I went down to this huge aerospace company, Ball Brothers Research Corporation, and applied for a, because I'd seen the advertisement for a technical librarian. Applied for the job and got it. So, which actually was a bit of a surprise to me. So all of a sudden, I was the head of a large technical library for a big aerospace company. They made the orbiting solar observatory. It was an incredibly beautiful piece of hardware. It got mounted on rockets and shot into the air and then circled around the sun to make observations. So it was a the library was quite large. You could not take things out of the company. I never because you had to have a clearance to work there. It wasn't military, but some of the technology was top secret. So I dealt with the documents, and I'm not sure exactly how it occurred that I began to computerize the library. I think part of the idea may have come from me because I had been interested in that since seeing how Goddard was doing it. And it was a fairly sizable lot library with documents, and the computer room was fairly close to where I was working. So I undertook the job to computerize the library. Now at that time, there were not a lot of known ways to do this. Not like now, you couldn't just pull up a soft, there was no application software. There were very few documents that told you how to do this. And essentially, was working with a computer that I had to program in Fortran. So I learned to program in Fortran. I took, this is your second question, but maybe I could integrate it into this
Yeah,
question
absolutely.
because it fits. Ball Brothers, at that time, like many other corporations, this was not the era of big computer science departments. It was 1969, or of all engineers and scientists knowing how to program. And the company went on a campaign against the what they call the slide rule engineers. They were still there then. They walked around the company with the slide rules in their pockets. So Ball Brothers decided everybody had to need to use the computer. And luckily for me, since I needed instructions how to do this, they were having they gave classes. So I joined the slide rule engineers and scientists and took classes in Fortran from his name was Dan Anderson, the fellow who ran the computer room and also taught the classes. And then I still had some questions about how to do it. So I took a summer institute at the University of Denver's, I think it was Graduate School of Librarianship, on systems, library systems analysis. Possibly the most important thing I ever did as far as my later career as writing electronic literature. In fact, it was so important to me to learn that way of thinking. It's not just programming, it's also a way of thinking. When you have a problem, the problem that faced me was actually not that difficult. And I had a staff, I had a woman who worked with me, Jo Sanford, who was who's also learning to program, so we worked on this together, and occasionally Dan Anderson helped us when we ran into blocks. But the most important thing was not the act of the programming, but the systems analysis, the act of how are we going to do this? And I like to tell electronic literature students, step back, because nowadays people are using applications, they don't always think this through. Step back, and you can even use the old-fashioned flowchart. Figure out exactly what you want to do. Think about the algorithms you're going to use. And I don't like to scare them too much, so I always use this book, The Art of Asking Your Boss for a Raise. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
No.
It's by Georges Perec, who's a member of the UPO, actually translated by David Bellows. And essentially, he was asked to write a rather humorous book about essentially using flowcharts. His book does not divide the work into a flowchart. He simply rambles on and on about the adventures of this poor fellow who was trying to get a raise and walks into his boss's office. Is the boss there? Yes. Is the boss there? No. Is the boss in a good mood? Is the boss in a bad mood? And somebody actually computerized this, which I also use to show students, so you can see how it works. It's kind of a wonderful example because Perec is a fairly well-known, experimental author, and this is entertaining and also introduces different ways of thinking about how you're going to create a work of some kind. I mean, I could say, and somebody might say, "Huh, creating a library catalog that's in which you put information that becomes searchable and you retrieve it is not so different from hypertext." But especially if you look at Uncle Roger, I played off the program I wrote for Ball Brothers.
Yeah, absolutely. But there was two comments that I picked up on in the Pathfinders interview related to this that I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about. So the first one was that you said that at that time you didn't intend to use computers in the later work that you would do in your artistic work. So how did those two things...
Not at all. I had no intention of that at all. There were two separate lives. In fact, as I think I told you via email, my immediate boss at Ball Brothers, and this is kind of interesting, was Jose Antonio Villarreal, who's a pioneer Chicano writer. So the company hired writers and artists, which I thought was kind of wonderful. Jose, quite shortly after that, was able to get a university job. But I don't believe he had an undergraduate degree the way I did. So we had to make a living. At the time, he was writing The Fifth Horseman, which is the story of the Mexican Revolution. His father actually fought with Pancho Villa. So I had one of the most best experiences working for Ball Brothers was Jose used to come up and talk to me sometimes about what he was working on. But my work, and I got one, I don't have too much out, but I did use words and images. And I was working in a fairly large scale. I don't know if you can see this. The light is kind of bothering me today. But I made things that were combinations of writing and pictures. Can you see that at all?
Yes, I can see it now.
This is a map, actually, a handmade map. That I made on rice paper, and then I had made versions that I sold on Xerox, not a lot, but a few copies. This is a color Xerox copy of a map that I made on rice paper. And essentially, these maps were narrative. They were under the category of what you would call artist books. But there was certainly no intention at all of using computers in my work. For one thing, you didn't have access in those days to there were no personal computers. All you had was a large, scary computer.
Yeah, and that was actually the second question, because
I could go ahead.
Because the second question you said, and you have no idea what a different experience it was using computers then compared to what it is now. So, but the conversation was in a different direction. And you didn't get a chance to develop that idea. So I thought, well, you're going there now, so that's
That's a
great.
good idea. I actually, they weren't so interested in that aspect, I don't think. And also, I don't talk about it too often, because it's so removed in some ways from where I work and what I do. If you tell it to people, in my mind, it isn't. But essentially, yes, you had. Now, I think I wrote you via email. It was a mainframe. I've been trying to research what computer I used. I'm not positive it was a mainframe. I'm pretty sure it was an IBM. I thought it was an IBM 1130, but those are smaller from the pictures than what I recollect. My recollection is a room about the size of a smallish bedroom, in which the whole wall was covered with a computer. And then there was a large, noisy printer. All you got, there was no monitor. So this is important. One reason that many people didn't think of using, there were people doing it, but certainly I didn't think of using it to create my work, was that, oh, we have a thunderstorm, can you hear
Oh
it?
yeah. Well, you need to.
I didn't use it to create my work. There was no monitor. The interactivity was limited. If people wanted to do a search on the system, the application you were creating, I would have to, first of all, I had to create the program on punch cards. That machine ran on a stack of punch cards. Every time you ran the program, you took the stack of punch cards into the computer room, put them on this conveyor belt, which ran across the room. The conveyor belt took the punch cards into the computer. If you did not have the correct start card on your stack of computer punch cards, you were in trouble, it wouldn't run. And then it ran the program, and then it printed out the results. So if somebody wanted to search for something, say guidance systems were the kinds of things they were looking for, they would, type they would give me what they wanted. I would have to create a punch card for that, and then I would integrate that punch card into the entire program and feed it into the computer, and we would come out with a printout of the documents in the library on guidance systems. So this is not an easy way to work. And in fact, it is not my recollection that the system we were creating was used a lot by the engineers. They were still happier to come in and say, "Can you just find this for us? And then we might use it." Because this was not like you could sit on your desk in your office or at home the way we can now and search a library catalog. It wasn't, for instance, it wasn't wired for one thing. 1969 was the beginning of ARPANET, and this technology was not
It's all.
accessible. At least there were a few people connected, but not in this company that I know. So essentially, the access was very different. The process was very different. It was finicky to a certain extent. I told the story in the Pathfinders interview, but I can tell it again here if you'd
Yeah,
like.
'cause it's lovely.
Yeah, I mean,
Well, it's lovely now. It wasn't so lovely then, no doubt.
this was a terrible moment.
What?
I had the program, the set the program we had created. It was a big stack of punch cards, about like so. I mean, this was not a small stack of punch cards. And they all had been kept in order also, if you dropped them very bad. And putting them in order was not easy. So I took the punch cards into over lunch hour. I didn't have access. You had to sign up for access to the computer. I had to use it over lunch hour because so as not to interfere with important engineer tasks. I took the cards in. I put it on the conveyor belt. I'm standing there, and all of a sudden, all the cards fly into the air. How this happened, I don't know. But when I was telling the story to Stuart Woolfrop during the Pathfinders interview, he told me the same thing had happened to Nancy Kaplan, who's his wife.
Yes.
I thought, oh, this must be something that happens occasionally. So I had to go find Danny Anderson, tell him what happened, and at the same time, because I think that at the same time, all those cards had to be put back in order. I mean, every time, which was not fun, but it was also horrendously embarrassing because it was sort of important to look professional when you're going into the computer room because not everybody was hugely in favor of, somebody who wasn't, a regular engineer using the equipment.
So I'm in asking this, I'm probably jumping forward in the timeline a bit, but so this idea then of bringing together the technology and the artist books, and so how did those ideas then start intertwining?
Okay, this was a bit of a longish process. I was creating various kinds of artist books, and after my son was born, and I think this is a good story. It's always nice to have a good story about how children influence your life.
Yes.
Well, being a parent of a young child, as I'm sure you know, it became difficult to create something like this that, had to stretch out across a drawing board. Sometimes children like to play on your drawing board.
Yes.
And a lot of times I was working during naps, or I didn't have that much time to work, or I was working in short bursts. And it started by just thinking, how can I do this? And I happened to have catalog cards accessible. I thought, why don't I try drawing on catalog cards? And I started drawing on the catalog cards without the vision of how I was going to use them eventually. And I started using text and I started using photographs. And I began to have this vision that I could create a non-sequential narrative using catalog cards. I had no access to a computer. This was 1976 when I started doing this. I had no access to the computer. I thought, well, I generally show my work in exhibitions. There weren't a lot of people showing computers, using computers in exhibitions, although there were a few. So I began making essentially what were small, I got small metal card catalog trays. I used cards that had writing on them, that had photographs on them, that had drawings on them. I categorized them as if it with text. But again, it was somewhat poetic text. So if I was telling a story, I would use a line, I would write a line of poetry, then behind the card and put that on a divider, like the old card catalogs on the top. And then behind the line of poetry, the narrative would be told by the images and the text and the photographs. Essentially, early multimedia. Not so different from what you might see. People working in creating narratives with images and all kinds of media. And I became almost obsessed with this, actually for a few years, to the point where I began to think, what the heck am I doing? Because I thought it was fascinating. It was wonderful training for becoming an electronic literature writer. I spent hours trying to make certain that the narrative worked exactly right. But what happened when I showed these works, where generally people just pull the cards out, I let them do that, and looked at occasional cards, they usually didn't experience the narrative the way I had intended them to experience it. And at that point, I began to stop and think, well, I'm enjoying doing this. I think this is great. But I can only make one copy, and I'm not sure I'm reaching the reader with these works. I then made a small switch to using, trying to use electromechanical books. Now, in those days, Radio Shack made these books. This was again the days before personal computers were hugely being used, although they were being used at that point, because I think I started in 1981 doing that. So I would purchase these houses for electromechanical address books from Radio Shack. I would open them up, take out the scrolls on the inside in which you were supposed to put addresses, and instead of the addresses, I would put images and text. And these books had little buttons in the front, so you could press the buttons and make them spin around.
Okay.
once again, it's a proto-generative hypertext structure. I also made some, they had another kind of address book. If you look at the start of the interviews in Pathfinder, you see I'm holding one up, although you can't tell what it is. But what I'm holding is a small address book that instead of pushing buttons, you advance it by pushing it like a scroll.
Okay, I know what you're talking about now. Yeah.
Have you ever seen those?
No, I just saw you holding it up in the Pathfinders
Yeah.
interview, but I couldn't really figure out what it was. Yeah. Okay.
I should have, I think there's one in the box over there, but I'm not sure, it might take a while. But essentially, it was a little, it looked like a small TV.
Okay.
I painted it, and the one in the picture is blue green because I painted it blue green. And inside that one, I've been to the bleachers of a baseball game, and taken pictures of mostly men, there were a few women on the bleachers. They were all very entertaining. And so I then took the photographs, color Xeroxed them to open the address book, took out the scroll that was in it, and substituted my own scroll of the pictures on the bleachers. So when you push the button, you could scan across the bleachers. Like a horizontal artist book. I don't know if you've ever seen any. J.R. Carpenter made one like that once. It's kind of wonderful. So those actually were big hits in exhibitions because they were fun to use. But about that time, so I still am not using computers, but I'm essentially simulating computer technology. To tell you the truth, I hadn't thought of using computers. Why? I don't know. I was using a process, you know, that partially because I worked by my hand, with my hands at that point, perhaps. I was using, you know, computer processes, and here we go back again to the influence of working with that, the influence of algorithmic thinking, how that had pervaded my own work without using the technology itself. But I wasn't actually using a computer. I started using a computer when my son wanted a computer. And we went and we didn't have a lot of money, but we went and bought a used Apple II computer. And he brought in Infocom games, all kinds of things. And at the time, I had another kind of work that I did that I won't spend too much time on, but I also made works of information art that collected information and then organized it in ways to look at the culture of technology, the culture of technology, and what is conveyed about technology in advertisements. So I had a project where I was collecting advertisements for computers. It was something I was interested in. And I took the slogans off them, entered them into, created a database. This one I didn't initially program myself. I used an early Apple II program called Visidex. But I quickly realized that if I wanted to distribute this, I had to write my own program. So this is how the first time I used computers since I left Ball Brothers in 1969, and it was 1986.
Okay.
So that's the 15 years or so.
I just wanted to ask, you know, when you mentioned about, I mean, quite aside from your artistic vision and quite aside from the resources and the facilities that were available to you, but you mentioned, you know, that incident with with the punch cards about how embarrassed you were because you had to seem, you had to act in a way that was considered professional,
Yeah,
and for example, the way the engineers would have looked on, and so I wondered, did those attitudes towards the computer and the things that went on around the computer, would do you think they in any way fed into your thoughts about it and the sort of thinking, yeah, this is something that can be used in an artistic sense or not, if you guessed where I'm going with that.
well, I'm coming to your question from reading Willard McCarty's interview, and I was so interested about his attitude to the computer, doing computer programming, And the men in suits, I don't know if you've seen in Uncle Roger, the men in tan suits. Oh no, the men in suits. And his attitude towards it, mine was a little different, but I didn't come away. I was really interested in working with information systems. And I learned a lot from that experience. I didn't mention that the professor of the systems analysis course I took was Richard M. Daugherty, who went on to be the head librarian at UC Berkeley and work on computerizing that catalog, went to the University of Michigan and worked on computerizing that catalog, again as head of the library system. And she was very good. He was very good at showing the thinking. But I've gone on a bit of a tangent here. A common Irish fault.
Yeah, well, I know all of it. Being Irish, I know all about that.
Like this. You ask a question, and I noticed that in Pathfinder's interview. I thought, okay, I've done what I usually do. Somebody asks me a question, and I go off on a story. And
But no, it's also good because, you're sort of, you're making clear the sort this the many ways that you encountered the technologies, the many attitudes, the many possibilities, and making clear that it shouldn't be seen in the context of only this, sterile professional something that seemed
Well, I think that I think that helps me answer your question a little bit. Yes, there was a complete gap between my work as an artist and writer and my work with information. I noticed the same thing with Jose Villarreal. I don't think he talked to too many people in the company about what he was doing, except maybe me. He may have. But I'm not sure you would have known. You couldn't wear pants into the company. You couldn't have long hair at that time in Colorado. I had to buy a wig. Yeah, I had long hair, and this is the late 60s. You couldn't wear short skirts. You couldn't even wear your hair in a ponytail. You could have a bun, but that's too library. So I ended up having to, I had to dress. For quite a while, for a while, not quite a while, for about a month or so, I think we were commuting. I was commute. I say we because my then husband was also working in a different technology company. We were commuting from his tent, and you had to get dressed. You had to wear. You had to look professional. You're out there, and the tent was up at about 5 altitude, about 5,000 feet up in the Rocky Mountains, and it was a long drive down. So you'd have to. Take a shower at the campsite, which was n not a very convenient shower. Put on, but it illustrates the contrast in the kind of two lives that I led, and I don't think it's totally uncommon. I mean, reading what Willard said in his interview, I could see that contrast again. It's interesting that he picked that up pretty quickly and used it in his own work. But yeah, I think what you're saying is actually a part of why I didn't connect it with my, I connected the thinking with my work. I learned a lot from the thinking. I was interested in information, but the idea of actually using computers, some of that attitude may have lingered. That means I go into a big room with a huge computer. I better look nice. If all the cards go into the air, this I think was perhaps a gender issue. I think I was the only woman using the computer room, and my colleague Jo Sanford was also a woman. We were the only women using the computer room. In some quarters, we weren't completely welcome, and that was just the kind of thing that would happen to us. Okay, I'm kidding. Well, I came into the computer room, and look what she did. So that was part of it. The other part was access. I mean, there would be no way, not totally true, I guess, but I didn't have access to a large computer system. And I just wasn't thinking about, it's not totally true I wasn't thinking about my work in that way, because certainly what I had learned about organizing the information systems, How I was looking at how information describes technology came from that experience, but no, I wasn't until we got the old Apple II running in my home. I didn't touch a computer.
Okay, so the let me look at the second question. I'm getting distracted now as well. So you wrote that you received two sessions of formal training in, and you've mentioned them. So there was at BBRC and there was the systems analysis at the University of Denver.
That's right. Yes.
Just when you were learning Fortran, for example, what was your impressions of it? What did you think of it?
It was hard. I was very good at systems analysis, although not in my recollection to the liking completely of Professor Doherty, who was had his own ideas. But for my own way of thinking, I was very good at systems analysis. I was very interested in it. The Fortran itself I found difficult. And occasionally I would get stuck on the programming, and I would go to Dan Anderson, and if he was in a mood to help, he would. He was actually very helpful, but he had a lot of other more important things. I think he was the only computer guy in his whole huge company.
Okay.
This again. So he had a lot of work to do. Occasionally, my colleague Jo Sanford was able to solve things I couldn't. My impression was she was a better hands-on programmer, but I was good at creating the algorithms and setting up the systems. So we worked pretty well together. But I'll tell you, when I started using, there's another issue here. When I started using BASIC, when I began to program again, that's just my phone, it'll stop soon.
Yeah.
I realized what one of the other problems was. There was no, I think there was one Fortran manual. Nowadays, if you want to learn a computing language, a programming language, you can get a whole shelf of books that'll help you. There are people you can ask who will help you. There was we My recollection is there was one Fortran manual, and that was it. There were none of these Fortran for Dummies, or here's how I did this in Fortran. It just wasn't available, because I found for myself when I started using BASIC, which is that it was hugely easier to use, and it wasn't BASIC's actually not that different from Fortran. It was partially because I had access to the University of California's libraries, and when I got stuck, I would go down to the basement with the air. There was an entire bank of at least 40 books on BASIC. I would go open them one at a time, 'cause, until I found out how to do what I wanted to do. You couldn't search online then. I also programmed Uncle Roger and Unix shell scripts, and there the community on the well was very helpful. But they weren't, the people I was working with weren't that knowledgeable of BASIC, so I had to use the books. But once again, this was not available when I was taking, when I was learning to program. And so what would happen was I was okay on how to write the program, but I would get stuck on how to do certain things. And the way we all do, I'm sure you've encountered that.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd get stuck on how to do certain things, and there really was not much help.
So what did you do? Did you hit dead ends or
Well, my recollection is we finally got the system working. It wasn't, a hugely, it was a bit of a kludge in a way. When I hit a dead end, sometimes Joe could look at it and figure out something different than I did. Sometimes Dan would help. Okay, here's where we went wrong here. And I also wasn't familiar, not only was I not familiar with ways of testing to find the bug, but also to test and find the bug on a punch card system is not as easy to test and find the bug on a, the kinds of systems we use nowadays. In other words, you can eliminate, if you can't find it by your eye, you can start running portions of the program until you find out which portion doesn't work. But when every time you had wanted to do that, you had to punch cards. Or and you didn't have that much access to the room. I mean, it was a much different, it was quite a bit difficult, more difficult.
And were you struck? You must have been struck then. I think you said it was almost 20 years later, was it, when you bought the apple for your son,
Let's
and you
see,
started
16, about 15 years or so.
15 years. You must have been struck by the. Did it seem easier then,
I was
when you
thrilled.
were? Yeah.
I was thrilled. I mean, this was a 1986 when this all came together to me for me. I was thrilled at how easy it was, and how I already had those skills. I knew how to think out the algorithms. I
Yes.
knew how to do the basic programming. I knew how to program the structures. I was finding it hugely easier than I did finding working at Ball Brothers. Some of that may have been the corporate situation. Some of it may have been it wasn't my own work, although I was interested in it. Or I was interested in it, but not excited about it.
Yeah.
Those are two different things.
Yeah.
I
For
liked working
sure.
with information. As I noticed also Willard had too, I enjoyed reading his interview. I was not financially able not to have a job, even though, because I didn't make that much money as an artist. So all of a sudden, all these things came together, and it wasn't that difficult. And I realized that not only could I do what I've been trying to do with the card catalogs, for not that long. Let's see, I started, well, actually, it was about 10 years. I started working in the card catalogs in 76, took 10 years before I could actually make the vision I had for the kind of literature they were going to be into something real by using the Apple II. And it was sitting on the desk in our house, it was right there. It was really, and on top of that, I had the enormous good fortune of having a very good friend, my old friend Carl Leffler, who ran an arts alternative art space in San Francisco, had worked early on, I think 1979, he worked on an early communications project, satellite using NASA technology. So he was interested in, he had some computer background, and he was Artcom, Flower Mills, Artcom, also did a fair amount of publishing, but they were always shorter, and they were like any alternative press, they didn't have huge amounts of money. And he came up with the idea of going taking this online, his whole gallery operations, and this was in 1986, and turning that into a place that he could not only communicate with people but publish art and get an audience. So he calls me up around April or March of 1986, and he said, "You've got to get online, Carl." He knew I was working with computers because he had seen the database I was making, and I didn't even know what he was talking about. He was very persuasive, so I went out and bought a modem. You had to buy a modem those days. I got online, and when I got there, it was such an extraordinary experience. I mean, nowadays we all grow up with this, but to actually be able to, even though it was slow, to log on to a computer and suddenly being talking to people in Canada, talking to Fortner Anderson in Canada, to Jim Rosenberg in Pennsylvania, Fred Truck in Iowa, and there was a conference system we could talk about. We had a software as art conferencing system. We could talk about what we were doing. But on top of that, you could convert the. I discovered that you could co-opt the conferencing system and tell narratives. It's how I first published Uncle Roger. I told people they would to bring in their own database system, because most people in that community had something like DBase at that time. So I published each Lexia with the keywords and said to the community, it was a fairly literate community, computer literate community, what you do with this is I'm going to put out Alexia every day like a serial, pull it into your database, use the keywords that I've given you, and you can make this work on your home computer. which this was in 1986. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah,
And
for sure.
on top of that, Carl set up a menu. Carl and Fred Trupp did the programming. So I'll say Fred just set up a menu, and where works could actually be published. And on top of that, we had an audience. This was part of what Carl was looking for. He had the idea that, okay, if you work in the conceptual art field or the performance art field or the video art field, your audience is pretty limited to the artists, other artists working in the field. That's who goes to the openings. That's who looks at the work. He thought the work was good enough that you could go to a wider audience. And all of a sudden, we had an audience too, and all of us came together at once.
Yeah.
Probably one of the most exciting years of my life.
I
And the
can.
minute that happened, now I have to note that this was all in text at this point. And therefore, I made a shift in my work. I was so thrilled by what I saw, I saw words could be used, how words could be manipulated by the computer, that I thought, okay, I can't use images here, but images to a certain extent add a different dimension. I'm going to start just working with words.
Okay.
Now, yeah, okay.
And do you think, because just as you were talking, I was just sort of thinking through the strands. I was trying to process, the various strands. So in one way, so many of your ideas preceded the technologies that you could implement them with. And then equally, I was beginning to think, and so what about those sort of colliding points where the ideas are colliding with the technology and how those changes are coming, the changes that result from that. So what you're saying about words seems to be going very much now in that direction.
Yes, I think in looking at some of the chapters in the book I just finished, this issue of the technology colliding with what you want to do comes up fairly often. Many people wanted to use images. It was also the lag, what they call at that time, was frustrating. The amount of time to get online, it was expensive too.
No, I don't necessarily, I don't really mean that. I mean, did the computer also become a sort of what's going back to Willard, what's it that Willard says, this exploratory tool, this
Yes, but maybe I was coming at it a little differently because I already knew what I wanted to do to a certain extent because I've been working with these card catalogs for so many years. It was exploratory, as I had to find out how to make it work on the system. But I wasn't maybe in a slightly different position than other people coming to the technology, the idea of making art, because I had a certain advantage of knowing what I was going to do. And I also could put it into practice very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, yeah, I came to it with a set of ideas, and I had the computer programming knowledge, even though I hadn't used it. And essentially, I was using the computer to fulfill a vision I already had. Now, I don't know how, but that's a little different than the way other people have approached it, I think.
Sort of yes and no. And I always think it's something that's very important to bring out in these interviews because, sometimes it's said that whether it's digital artists or digital humanists or whoever digital you want, that they that the technology drives what they're doing. But
Oh.
as you've been so carefully explaining, no, that wasn't the case at all. Or it's that the ideas were there and being developed well before the means through which you could computerize
That's
them
right. I think
became available.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, I might also say this may go back to the beginning with working with systems analysis, or the beginning with a problem. Okay, I already have the problem.
Yeah.
There are so many documents and books in the Ball Brothers library. I want to the engineers and scientists in this country to be able to access them. That's the problem. And I'm not starting out playing with the technology. I'm starting out solving a problem.
Yeah.
And most of my work, I do that even now. In other words, I come up, okay, when I start a new work, this is the narrative I'm going to do. I start with the content. And then I design the, I think this is partially because I don't use a lot of applications. If you use application software, you're limited to a certain amount away by what it can do. I also work at I don't use a lot of multimedia. I work with words, but I start with what I want to do. I say, okay, this is the narrative. I'd like to tell this narrative in this way. I then start working. I write a little bit so I know what it is, and then I start working on the authoring system. So I'm not. I usually still continue to work from scratch, so to speak. I'm not, I'm generally not using a program other than my, I mean, I'm using HTML or I'm using JavaScript, or in the past, in the early days, I was using BASIC or Unix shell scripts. And then I try to fit the authoring system to the work itself. Now, there's no doubt that there are times I get stuck. And I'm recently have been stuck in a few places, trying to force JavaScript to do what I want. And I have various ways of doing that. Sometimes I'll bang my head against the wall until it works. Or I'll find often nowadays, instead of having to go to the basement of Berkeley's library, you can go and Google and search. Other times I'll think, well, there must be some other way to do what I want. And I'm not sitting there. I mean, this is a little bit of a difference again between how some digital artists work, not all, or how I work and how a computer scientist might work. I'm not sitting there thinking, I have to write a perfect program. That is not my aim. My aim is I have to write a program that displays what I want it to display or does what I want it to do. If I use a hack to get that happening, I'm not concerned. So yeah, I run up against snags. I've got a few recently that I've run up against, and sooner or later I manage to solve them. Sometimes it can take a long time. I mean, this is an issue that always comes up with students of electronic literature also, I think, that you have to be aware that you can't always take your idea and put it into practice in, 2 days. If you have a final project, you might be lucky and it might work, but it might not. And particularly at this stage in the field, where we are still exploring and experimenting, we're kind of like musicians in the Middle Ages, when music composition theory and practice was developed. We are still developing those things. So we can't necessarily expect that something is going to happen, that we're going to get what we want overnight. Or if we're using an application, there's some pretty good, I mean, StorySpace, for instance, was a wonderful application. You still were, to a certain extent, had to work within the application. It's always been my contention that if you do that, the person who designed the application is, to a certain extent, a co-author, because you are working within that system. But I don't actually object to that at all. I think a good application like Inform7 or StorySpace is really at the heart of the field. It's just that for the work I want to do, I generally prefer to come up with my own authoring systems.
The next question is, How did, well, the question that I initially asked was, how did you first get involved in what we now refer to as digital humanities? I think you've probably covered a lot of that. Is there anything that you want to add before I want to go on to a question related to that?
Well, here we have the issue of something you're much more knowledgeable than about than I am. What is digital? What does that mean, digital humanities?
Yeah.
Where's the place? Is there a place for electronic literature in digital humanities or not? It's a big question.
So well,
That everybody's, that I don't think there's one answer to.
no, I don't think, not so long ago, my colleagues and I published a book called Defining Digital Humanities: A Reader,
I saw
and
that, and I'm going to pick that up and read it.
yeah, it's very nice. It's mo there's a couple of new chapters, and it's mostly sort of reprints of some of the most highly
Yeah.
cited articles. But anyway, so as will come as no great surprise, the thing that we decide at the end is that there is no definition, and probably we shouldn't even have a definition, or at this stage, a definition isn't useful because it shuts down the work, so to speak. But if I, so the question that I was going to ask related to that, is maybe equally impossible to answer, but I was thinking, say, in terms of the so-called humanities computing stroke digital humanities work that you would have encountered, what did you think of it? Did you think it was interesting?
I find very interesting, and one thing that I think not enough has been done with is looking at the systems of, for creating, digital humanities databases, the kinds of things you've worked on, how that software works, how that might be applied to creating electronic literature, how in some ways electronic literature is reversing the process. And what the contingencies are, I don't think there's been enough done in that field. And I myself would like to spend more time looking at digital humanities processes. And it's on my list. And I don't, I actually have thought it was quite wonderful that in some places or in some, conferences, that electronic literature is being shown in conjunction with digital humanities work. I think we in electronic literature should be looking more closely at what you're doing also.
That's interesting, because sometimes I have the feeling that electronic literature is this very sort of exciting avant-garde space of exploration, and sometimes I think digital humanities, in contrast, maybe isn't doing as exciting or cutting-edge work. I don't know what you think about a statement like that.
Well, I know what you're saying. I think it depends on the project. And some of the things I've looked at, thought, well, this is actually very, exciting to me, because there are similarities. Again, I might use reverse engineering, but I'm curious as to how you're organizing the information. What program you're doing that with, how you're retrieving the information, what the information is, what you're learning from that. I think these are, to me, these are not boring questions. These are very interesting questions. But I do work a little closer to the bone in my work than some electronic literature writers, probably because of my background. In other words, I work more closer to the algorithmic bone, and then I don't than some writers of electronic literature. I'm interested in this in algorithmic thinking. I'm interested in, the processes and how things are done. I think there would be a lot to learn in my electronic literature community from the, digital humanities community, and I see a contingency also. I like being associated with that community. And to me, it isn't boring, it's interesting. But this may be partially because I come from also, I did a lot of library work.
Yes.
Which is not, I don't know if There might be a few other people who in my community who've done that, but it's not so common.
Yeah, no, it's not. In even within digital humanities, it's not. Well, I mean, it's reasonably common, but for example, our digital humanities program is in a library. We're a Department of Information Studies, Library and Information Studies, and I think we're one of the few in Europe to have digital humanities situated within that kind of a context. Anyhow, let me, instead of me rambling on, let's look at the next question. So, I think then probably the next question that we would go to is, so I had, what about scholars who were not using computers in their research? Do you have some sense of their view about humanities computing? But again, I'm asking that in a very broad sense.
I looked at that question with interest and thought, well, I have to, I don't want to go into much. I'm sure you've encountered this too, the cold shouldering occasionally by, humanity scholars, and the cold shouldering by, it's common in the field. And I had a couple of stories I thought I'd tell in response to that. Sticking somewhat to the arts community and the writers community, the first one concerns John Cage, who in 1986 or 7, I'm not sure which, published a work on ARTCOM called the First Meeting of the Satie Society, and Carl put it on the menu, or Fred actually formatted it. And so we had a big party for, and invited John to come out. And he came out to the party. I'd never met him before. And I started talking to him, and we were talking about working just this subject. What is going to be the reaction? He said, he told me that about in 1952, when he had done Silence was the work in which the musicians put down their instruments and did not play, and the whole work was about the no the trying to hear the noise in the area. That for years many people did not speak to it, and I thought that was really surprising because Silence is now a very famous work. Yes, it's challenging. What is music? And yes, he asked the musicians to put down their instruments. But when he was telling this to me, I began to see what he was saying. I think what he was saying to me was, expect trouble. Expect trouble. And on his own account also, because at that point, it's always easy to think that artists are famous all their lives. They aren't. They run into a lot of problems. I mean, and I actually went and looked later, so I didn't believe that there was that reaction to Silence, because it's such a celebrated work, but there was. So I think that's what he said. Stuck in my mind for years, and I noticed that after I started, I made an immediate switch. I saw right away, this is what I want to do. That meant I was changing a little bit, from what I was doing, and I don't think within the visual arts there was such a problem. There's been a bit of a larger problem in the literary arts with electronic literature. Now, this is a difficult subject, and it's my perception that I'm talking about. Oh, but within the visual arts, we have a long tradition of very challenging work. A long tradition of, moving from different way approaches of, people not accepting abstract art being accepted, of, challenging genres, like, or challenging communities such as the Fluffist community, of performance art, of various kinds of art that challenge people, and the whole of the visual arts community has accepted this. This is a little less prevalent in the literary community. It's there, but it's not at the heart, such as the heart of the community. So I think the situation is changing. But I also think I also wanted to say, and I think you may have heard this, I'm going to have to find my notes to read this. Stuart Moulthrop pinpointed this a bit when let me see what I want to see exactly what Stuart said here, if I can find it. Find it here. Okay. So far, I haven't found it. Okay. All right, so I was talking to Stuart on the Pathfinders in I don't know if you got to this part on Pathfinders, and we were talking about, the role of electronic literature in the literary community. And I said to him, it was so helpful when Robert Coover wrote those articles the series of articles for the New York Times. It really brought a lot of attention to electronic literature. We were reviewed in the Washington Post. We were reviewed in a lot of places. And Stuart said no. He said no. He said that's when we attracted the attention of the police. This is his word. And that's when the critic stepped in and said no, this is not good. And I think what he was saying, and I actually argued, I didn't argue with him, but I said, okay, I know what you're saying. This is when there are so many poets who write chapbooks. There are so many good poets not in this country, everywhere, who spend their lives reading poetry, and they're not getting a full page in the New York Times Book Review. And all of a sudden, electronic literature is getting all this attention. And it's not so much a question of they don't like electronic literature. It's a question that in a community that gets so little coverage anyhow, and this is true of any art form, there's going to bound to be hostility if electronic literature attracts a lot of attention and is a new field. And there are some other issues also, and I think this issue hasn't been addressed enough. I mean, personally, I'm going to preface this by saying, personally, I think electronic literature and print literature are both literature, and eventually we will be considered both literature. I do not want to lose print literature, and would feel absolutely horrible if anything if that happened. I mean, the book is a wonderful interface, but it's just a different interface.
Absolutely.
And so I have always wanted to be, considered that what I do is literature. But there is another way of looking at that, and a way that may be somewhat frightening to print writers. I don't think it should be, because they do something different. And that is, there's a certain set of skills involved in writing electronic literature that not everyone has. And I think the best comparison for that is music composition. In other words, not everybody can compose music. It requires a certain set of skills.
What so could you briefly outline what you think those skills are, or is it possible to outline what those skills what you think those skills are?
That's a difficult question because so many people are approaching. Here we are, as if it were the Middle Ages when there were theory composers who wrote long treatises on the way they were composing music. Contemporary notation was not there then. There was a certain beauty that you could compose any way you wanted to, and score it any way you want to. But I say that the set of skills, if we're returning to the basic question you're asking, you don't have to use programs, you can use an application. It is still a different skill than writing poetry. It's a different skill than writing print fiction. It's a skill that I don't think it's necessarily a difficulty issue. As children, we grow up reading print literature. We grow up writing in school, or we grow up reading in school. We are familiar, and if you step back and look at poetry, if you look at print literature, if you look at the novel, these are all constraint-based art forms to a certain extent, but there are forms that we are familiar with. Now, at this point in time, it may be that there at some point in time you don't need to have a different set of skills the way a music composer of music does. But at this point in time, you have to have not only a writing skill or but also the ability to manipulate the words in the same way a composer manipulates notes. Now, I should also be saying, I'm talking here about hyperfiction, about interactive fiction, about generative poetry. I'm not talking about much of electronic literature as multimedia, and it's done with applications. It's approached quite differently. So I know this, I hope I'm, this isn't too difficult to follow. And I know, and I'm not certain that I'm giving you a great answer here. I should maybe set that forth myself a little more in writing.
Yeah, no, don't, it's as you say, it's something that's incredibly different to answer anyhow, isn't it?
I think it's also different because everybody in the field at the moment approaches it differently. Now, I think that's good.
Yeah, that's
I think it's healthy at this point. I don't like to see us in the electronic literature field, being saying this is the which everything should be created in Twine, everything should be created in Form 7, everything should be created in processing. These are different authoring systems. I like us, and I like to see students also step back and say, and this is something I tend to say to students, what is your vision? What is your vision? Your vision, not where the software is going to take you. And this goes back to your earlier question. What is your vision to what you want to create? What, and then let's look at is there an application that will do that? Or if not, how can you do that? And some students can become very excited by that. Others can say, you know, I don't think so.
Yeah, but I guess that's sort of one of your key points in terms of these skills that are needed, and it's in some ways to be able to think in this way, completely independent of whatever technology might be used to express it or realize it.
Well, it's also important as far as preservation goes to be looking at what you're creating, and to be in some way for yourself scoring it so that it can be recreated if the technology disappears, which is another issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just. Okay, so I think the next one was.
I thought the roundabout answer I've given you there too. Once again, I went into, I think Irish narrative, Irish storytelling is somewhat hypertextual in a way. If you go like this, you go like this, you go like that, and you go like that, and you tell four stories and you expect the audience to understand it. So I apologize. I talk like that sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's conversation is all the better for it, I think. Okay, so I think we were going to briefly say about if you wish your impression of the conference community, the type of conference communities that you encountered.
Okay, coming from an art background, before I went to a conference, I could not understand why anybody would want to do that. I thought, no, we went to openings, they were free, you did not have to pay for them, you were never asked to pay to talk. It was either free or you were paid. And I couldn't see why you would want to sit around a room, you would want to do that. The minute I went to a conference, I completely changed my mind. The first conference I went to was in 1989. It was San Jose State. It was a conference on computer art, which was rare at that time, sponsored by the National Computer Graphics Association, I think, and CADRA, which is a early a digital arts department in San Jose State. And I was invited to be on a panel along with quite a few various other people from Art Palm, Carl and Cooley and Fred Truck, and let's see, There are Robert Edgar, I think Howard Besser, was there also, who's actually connected more with the museum computer people. So it was a mix of people. It was the first time I'd ever spoken at a conference or been to a conference. And I was amazed at the interaction. It was very different from going to an art opening or a reading, in that, you were meeting people, there was a lot of information exchanged. There was, very targeted. It was exciting. And so I did change my mind about conferences. But I don't know, I was run down about 1994 and have been on crutches ever since. So I don't go to a lot of conferences anymore, unless they're in my area, which I miss.
And then I was going to ask about those who particularly influenced you and how, and they can be from any sphere whatsoever.
Okay, I like to start with, I always, with just the librarians who worked in the early days with early library retrieval systems, because I think that they aren't given enough attention. And there are quite a few women, Henrietta Avram, I'm never sure if I'm pronouncing your name right, was Parker, Richard Daugherty, who I was lucky to take a systems analysis class with. If you look what they were doing, essentially Ted Nelson took that and romanticized it and has gotten all the credit. Now, I think he deserves a lot of credit, but at the same time, when you're looking at hidden histories, and particularly since there are quite a few women involved, and I don't, it's not my subject, so I haven't been following the scholarship in this field, but it doesn't come up, in newspaper articles or in the kind of literature that everybody reads. It's a field of scholarship that they think I would certainly like to see more. So I want to credit all those unsung librarians who developed ways to automate libraries and automate retrieval, because that's deeply important to the culture and it, our culture, and it runs beneath hypertextual systems essentially. And there's not much difference between a keyword and a link if you look at it in that way. So I think that's important. I've already talked about John Cage. John Cage, his work lies beneath everybody's work in I think in experimental literature. And certainly many of the works he's done have been influential on my work. I'm thinking of his interdeterminate, I can never pronounce the word, interdeterminate. Okay, I'll have to send you the word. Occasionally I get hung up on pronunciation. But he created this work years ago in which someone challenged him, I think it was David Tudor. He was asked to speak a lot and he never knew what to say. And he was, I think David Tudor suggested that he just tell stories. So he started telling very short stories. Alexia's work, he numbered them. They were all about his life and the people he worked with. And he and David Tudor created a work where in one room, Cage read those stories, in another room, Tudor played one of Cage's piano concertos, and they did not hear each other. And they were timed, so Cage had to time his stories. And a recording was made by putting together two screens. And this is the kind of thing that Cage did. I mean, he did lectures where he created concentric circles and he put words in them. And so many of the things he did, so many of, we would call them constraints in the electronic literature community of this, are so embedded in what we do nowadays, and that I think he's very important. Also, of course, Virginia Woolf and James Joyce and Dorothy Richardson, the three writers who tried to break the conventional narrative never succeeded completely to change that. I'm not so certain that it should be changed. I personally also love Jane Austen. And so I once again is like looking at electronic literature and literature as parallel streams. But their work was so important in looking at writing in a different way, exploring writing in a different way, and in saying we don't have to write a novel in this way. So I think their influence is very continues to be very pervasive. On a personal level, my friend of 35 years, Sonia Rappaport, who died this June,
Oh, I'm
greatly
sorry.
missed by me and by many others, who was a created art. She was a visual artist and used information in her work. She created scrolls. She integrated computers into her work. The first time I met her was, I think, in 1980 or 81, when I went to an installation in 80 Langton Street called Objects on My Mother's Bureau. And she had created a work where she had taken the objects, objects, I think it's Objects on My Dresser, taken the objects and written stories about each object, what they were. And then on the floor, she had this huge structure called a net web. This was way before the web, where the writing and the work she did with the psychiatrist about each object was all laid out like a piece of information. Then she did another work called Shoe Field, where she asked people to come in, take off their shoes, and input into a computer what they thought about their shoes. And works, she didn't program, she worked with a programmer who created a program to make an array out of each person's statement. So you would take off your shoes, you would put in the information, and you'd get back a printout of some the kind of printout that people in your field make nowadays. That the these beautiful graphs. And so we talked. After we met, we had in common working with information. We weren't in direct competition, which I think is helpful because I work more with narrative, with words, and she worked more with images. And for over 35 years, we used to talk all the time. We would call each other up. I still almost every day I think, I gotta talk to Sonia about that. I'm working on this problem. I need to talk to Sonia. I can't call her, so it makes me so upset. But and she was 20 years older than me, so she was kind of more than that, actually, a fair amount older than me. She was kind of like an art mother, also. I think everybody needs an art mother. So certainly she was influential in my life. And then, like we've already talked about Carl Loeffler, I'd like to say a few words about Mark Bernstein because he's so important in the hypertext community. He did something incredible. He was working with the hypertext community, just not the literary community. And he said, people are asking, where are the hypertexts? He said, I'm going to show them. It's rare to have such an innovative publisher who works with your work. He put out, oh, I don't know how many titles, but over 30, maybe 30 to 60 titles. I took a look recently when we were talking about women, representation of women. Half of them were women. He worked with people. He was very good at seeing things. He picked up Story Space from Michael Joyce and the other people who worked on Story Space, and made Story Space publicly available. He managed to attract attention. The works, I still think the works that came out of Eastgate, which is his company, are certainly among the best in the field. And so I like to give Mark a lot of credit. And I'm sure I've left off a lot of people, but that's a start.
Yeah, that's absolutely the story.
I know people ask you this question, they ask me this question, and sometimes I say something completely different because someone's work is on my mind.
The next section has been purposely silenced, and the tape resumes as we're discussing the issue of whether Judy Malloy regrets not having secured a full professorship.
I don't have a PhD. I did not come from the era when PhDs were given. Generally speaking, poets of my age don't need that, but the situation has changed there, and it is difficult to continually. I mean, I had a wonderful 2-year visiting professor job at Princeton. Visiting professors are visiting professors, they aren't full professors. I would love to find something else like that again, but and it occasionally seems difficult to me the amount of hoops I will have to, and the amount of letters I'm going to have to send out to get that. But
Yeah.
then anybody coming out of graduate school faces the same thing.
Yeah.
My
And
son does, I know my son, who now teaches, my son's a historian, and he's now a professor at UC Merced. And he had, great credentials coming out of Berkeley with a PhD from Stanford, but it still took him 4 years to get a full-time professor job.
yeah.
He was, so it's not as if, it isn't a, and I think it's not as if it's not a difficult situation for anyone. I would prefer a much better situation. I love teaching electronic literature. I love teaching social media narrative. I would be so happy to find a place to do that again. At the moment, I don't have it.
Section purposely silenced to resume shortly.
I think in my case, I started teaching, well, I have taught before also, but I taught at the San Francisco Art Institute, I taught MFA students for Arizona State University Summer School, and I worked with students various other ways. I'm now at an, when I was younger, I accepted actually with some happiness the dual career situation. And there have been plenty of, I mean, T.S. Eliot, did you work at a bank? I forget
Yeah.
where. Hawthorne worked as a shipping clerk.
Yeah. Larkin was in a
I
library, actually, wasn't he?
Who says
Lar
that?
Philip Larkin was in a library,
Yeah,
wasn't
I think
he?
so.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are good jobs for poets and writers because libraries, particularly, are lovely. They're quiet, the work is interesting. I was not unhappy with that at all when I was in mid-career stage, although occasionally as a single parent I was juggling an awful lot between the two careers and being a parent also. So it wasn't until recently, and I think this is an age thing partially, that I felt I have so much to pass on to students. I'm so thrilled working with students. I love the work they do. I want to see the work they do. I like all people in my field, I have different opinions than others do in my field. I will get irritated when I see what I think is a shallow course in electronic literature. I want students to write electronic literature. I have the skills to work with them. I have the knowledge to show them how to do that. And if I feel blocked, it's because I want, there's some, I want students to see all the aspects of electronic literature. I want to work with students. Now, if I had been born in a different era, would I have gotten a PhD? I don't know. I liked what I was doing. And I don't, I'm also very aware, whether or not I feel blocked, the situation is, it's a difficult situation for anybody in the field to get employment. Nevertheless, I feel as if maybe I only have so many years left, and it's important to me to work with students to essentially pass the small part, the small torch. We all have different torches in electronic literature. To pass the small, the knowledge that I have about how to make it work.
Oh, that's really beautiful, I have to say.
Good.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I didn't.
Section intentionally silenced. Tape to resume shortly.
I like to tell people I work for the Goddard Space Center or Ball Aerospace. They go, huh? You what?
Yeah. No, when you see, so for the book that I'm working on, it's with to be published with Springer, and it'll be out in 2016. And so I've done, I don't even know how many interviews I've done at this point, and really trying to get quite a wide, you know, people from many different backgrounds. And I think that's one of the amazing things about it. All those areas that people worked in that you never, the jet propulsion lab, the links with Lockheed, all these different contexts that you wouldn't necessarily have realized would actually seem to be really important to the development of the discipline in later ways.
What about the other? Does someone else have a link to Lockheed?
Yeah, so the link to Lockheed is Hans Rutemann. And when he was with the MLA, when they decided to put it online, so to speak, he flew to Lockheed and worked with them in order to make it, I think that was the late 60s, in order to make it accessible. And then Mary D. Harris, she was working with this jet propulsion lab in Pasadena. And
That's really fascinating. I mean, this is very interesting to me because I didn't like to talk about that, although it was germane to my. I don't mind now because I've sort of just gone over an age hump, practically, where I don't, you know, I realized this was important. And the companies in that era, you know, Bell Labs was like that also. The R&D companies in that era were very open to who they were hiring. I was asking about Lockheed. I think Jose worked at Lockheed also, although he doesn't put it on his resume. He's not alive anymore. So that's, they didn't hesitate at Ball Brothers to hire artists and writers. They didn't hesitate to hire someone who had just been bumming around Europe and here, and say, hey, you want to computerize this card cap, this art library? Nowadays, that would never happen.
No, it also comes out in with Susan Hockey. So when she was hired by the Atlas Computing Lab, she had come out of Oxford having done a degree in ancient Near Eastern languages, had no experience. They hired her into that role. Willem Ott, it comes out with, is so there's a real interesting strand to all of it. Yeah, so definitely people will be interested.
I'm really looking forward to that because I feel like I'm less out on a limb hearing that. And I think that there is some credit due to those companies which people, you know, who don't tend to look at askance and, they're not doing it anymore, I don't think. But at that time, they were, and I think this also has to do with it's post-war enough, or closer to World War II, that what women did during World War II was still remembered. And companies thought, you know, that as a woman you had some skills and you could come in and do that. And they were actually right a lot of times. And they didn't hesitate to hire Willard either. I actually beat him one run down on my physics grade. It was a D. It was a D in physics. I punched him because I argued with the professor. But I thought, see, I got a D in physics. Worst grade I ever got. But it was also partially because the professor in question made it very clear at the beginning of the class that, and this was in the 1960s, that he did not think women should be in physics. Nowadays you would be fine.
Yeah, and rightly so.
And rightly so. And clearly he was going to be very hard on the women also. And in fact, the dean actually called me in later and said, you know, we don't want you to be discouraged from going into the sciences, because I won't name his name, because this particular professor did that.
Thanks.
Yeah. actually, although I was good at the sciences, didn't want to go into the sciences, but I thought it was nice that the dean took the trouble to do that.
Yeah.
She was a woman.
Okay.
Because that wouldn't, in that era, that wouldn't necessarily have happened.
Yeah. Okay, so to close up, the final question that I would ask is, do you have any disappointments about whether this is social, cultural, intellectual, technological, whatever, about routes that electronic literature didn't take?
Well, I don't put it quite that way. I still think of this as an incredibly open field. I mean, when I started working using applying the computer to what my work in 1986, I part of the excitement was I saw, oh my gosh, there are so many ways we can manipulate words. There are thousands of things we could do. If I have a disappointment, it goes to why I want to teach and why I like people with knowledge of the history to teach. It's that a lot of the work that is coming out today, and maybe I don't want to publish this either, or I can think of a better way to put it. I think the positive way to put it is emphasizing the history, but I don't quite see that. Taking electronic literature into the field of multimedia. That's a different field. And I'm also, because I've worked as an editor for Leonardo and because I've worked as an editor for the New York Foundation for the Arts, I'm also cognizant of what comes out of the art schools. And a lot of times it's much better, they have better training than people in what to do. So I look at these things and I say, why? I see people who work on words leaving words. And I say, why aren't you doing this? And partially they are doing it because that is more encouraged.
Right.
And it's also, I mean, someone actually said to me or implied to me that one reason that the electronic literature community was going that way was the hostility from the literary community. There was far less hostility if we use words and we create multimedia. And by the way, I think a lot of the works created with multimedia are totally wonderful. I just want to see, I want people to also see that there are ways to work in words that are so incredible that we haven't explored, that I hope there will be some people who will work in those ways.
Okay, brilliant.
I'm
Thank you
going
so
back to my arts.
much.
After years of working as an arts advocate, when I was editing Artsware covering the way it became Michael Karin for the New York Foundation for the Arts, I realized I had to take the attitude, and it rubbed off on me that all art forms are good.
Yeah.
Because, and at first I balked at that, being a critical poet artist, and later I began to see because I had to cover everything. That is correct. Everybody has their, and any kind of work, any work of literature, any work of art, when the artist has a vision, if you spend enough time with that artist or poet's or writer's vision, you will see what they are trying to do and will appreciate it. So I do wish that there would be more time spent with looking at simply word-based electronic literature, but who knows what the future will bring?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so thanks a million. That was just
Well,
really
thank you.
fascinating.